I'm standing in front of the Burj Dubai, the tower in the desert, this shard of steel and glass amongst the sands of Arabia. It's the tallest building in the world. It's what Dubai, particularly, and the Emirates in general, have become famous for. Is this the future, or is this now the past of architecture in this zone and of our cities in general? Because we're going to see a new city, Masdar, an environmentally friendly city growing out of the sand here.
What's the role of water, material, energy, mobility in the city of the future?
We really need to create some new cities as good examples.
The glass towers of Dubai, the glass towers of London, really have no long-term future.
My first glimpse of Masdar City comes not from the sand of the Arabian Desert, but on the banks of the Thames, just near Battersea in London, at the headquarters of Foster Partners Architects and at the desk of Gerard Evenden, who's the chief architect of this city. From this angle, it looks like a wedge of green and brown amongst the desert. There are two blocks of what look like fairly dense housing, surrounded by large flat cylinders. So what's around the city?
The important thing about the site itself is, first of all, its boundaries. The site itself is approximately 7 square kilometres. What's inside the squares is a completely mixed-use integrated city. We're not talking about a city which is just residential. We're talking about scientific research buildings, the Masdar Institute, the university. Along this central spine, which runs through, it connects through the centre of the city, is a light railway, and that really becomes the high street. What we've done is to create community clusters, so within those communities you will have services like the corner shop, the medical centre, and if you look across the river there and you look at London, the mix of the community, the residential community, is very important, and that's what integration's about.
The two things this city lacks in comparison to a lot of modern cities is, first of all, massive steel and glass towers, and secondly, sprawl.
Density is critical. Sprawl must be controlled. If we were really going to try and do this city in this way, we had to do it within the confines of our site and really test what was the balance of the land. The climate, because it's such a harsh climate here, it pushes everything to the extreme. So are you really testing it? Yes, you are.
One of the things it actually reminds me of images for development on other planets, insofar as it has that very hostile environment around it, and you've tried to kind of contain it in a bubble. It looks like some of those Martian prototypes to me.
Well, I think lunar technology has begun to influence our thinking, because if you think about the moon, you have a very cold environment, and you're trying to keep the warm inside your building. In Abu Dhabi, the opposite's true. What you're trying to do is keep the heat out, you're trying to keep the cool in. Initially you think nice big heavyweight materials, build it like a big old cathedral. It's the wrong answer, because what happens is if you bake a big stone for long enough, eventually the stone gets hot and eventually it radiates inside. Mm-hmm. What you want is you want a lightweight, very reactive skin, just like the lunar module. We're trying to seal the building. We are putting a big piece of insulation to keep the heat out, and then we want to reflect off the heat. The obvious material is actually foil. The important thing about foil is that foil doesn't retain heat. We've put what are called ETFE cushions, which are big plastic inflated cushions, and when it heats up, it only ever gets to ambient air temperature.
It is rocket science.
and that's what's driving the laboratory's design.
How genuine do you think the people behind the Masdar project are about the environmental side? Because Emiratis have a reputation, well, for exporting a lot of oil and also for, you know, buying Range Rovers and leaving them in the desert when they run out of petrol.
Economics of the country are based on the production of energy, and what's happened is that the government has recognised very clearly that just as technology's changing, energy needs will change. Nobody had created a place to bring those things together. And so there were lots of people working on projects in a very separate, individual way. And what was required was a Silicon Valley. And perhaps that now is what Abu Dhabi's beginning to generate, is the Silicon Valley of renewable energy.
And here I am, now, out in Abu Dhabi with the sands of the desert under my boot. The revolutionary eco-city of Masdar emerging from the dust on my right. It's actually quite appropriate that we start right here because I'm actually next to a massive solar power plant. There's solar panels here stretching across an area of, I don't know, at least 10, probably 20 or more football pitches. And this was the foundation stone for the city, in effect, because they thought, right, well, we've got to build a sustainable city. We need a lot of energy to do that. So the first thing we're going to do is build a plant to make that energy.
Right now we are standing at a 10 megawatt solar power plant, which is the biggest in the MENA region, Middle East and North Africa. And this is the only power plant as of now being connected to the grid.
You built this almost before you built the city, or at the same time as you were building the city. But it occurs to me that there isn't much electricity being used in building that. There's a lot of diesel, there's a lot of, you know, baking cement and things like that.
So, as of now, when the construction is going on, the city doesn't require much power. What's happening from here is whatever is being generated here is being connected to the grid, Abu Dhabi Distribution Company grid, which is getting the green power.
Solar power can also address any desert city's other big problem, water. There'll be intensive conservation and reuse of water here, but it will come from the sea, and you need energy to take the salt out. Solar energy. I can see a whole load of mirrors pointing at the sun, and in the middle, a lot of mirrors arranged around a disc. It looks a bit like one of those tripod things from the War of the Worlds. Three legs, about, I don't know, 30 metres high or so, with a big disc in the middle, about 5 or 6 metres across. Well, as we're standing here looking at this new solar facility, all the mirrors on the ground are gradually shifting round, and you can see the light that they're reflecting is now being beamed up to that disc in the middle that's hanging between the tripod legs, and in turn is being reflected down to a mirror on the ground. Now, this isn't fully operational yet. This particular part of the solar plant is still being built, and it's not photovoltaic, that is to say, electricity-generating solar panels like you might see on people's houses. It's concentrating the heat onto a particular point. As we've been speaking, the beam of light has just moved off the disc, and all the mirrors are gradually tilting back. The fact that they're still experimenting here is very much part of the Masdar story. They're not just buying existing renewable technology off the shelf. They're trying to experiment and develop new stuff to push the boundaries. They've got the time, they've got the money, they've got the ambition to do that. They want to make it work the best it possibly can.
This is the experimental bed or the experimental facility that the Masdar Institute and our students will be using to get acquainted with this technology.
I've just been up there and seen that incredibly bright pool of light. Yeah. What would happen to me if I stood in there?
It's a nice barbecue.
Oh, really?
I'm not going to eat you,
How long would I last? Not long in there.
It's around 500 degrees, so really? You feel it.
What is going to be better about this system than existing sun-to-heat-to-power systems that there are around already?
Whenever you have something on the ground, it's easier to manage, so you have less radiation losses and all so forth, okay? The other trend is to build massive, huge. So this idea of having this multi-tower could really reduce the overall price of the energy production, okay?
Where do you come from yourself?
I'm from Norway.
Yeah. How exciting is it for you to be working on a project
like this? First of all,
it's
sunny and it's not cold, but it's a unique experience. As I told you, there is no university in the world that gives this kind of possibility.
And there's money for scientists, engineers like yourself to have fun, and yeah, maybe even get it wrong sometimes.
Getting it wrong, you know, it's always part of science, isn't it?
Science can go wrong, but whole cities aren't so forgiving. This isn't the first promised eco-city that costing the earth has followed. Dongtan in China swept us up with green dreams beyond even Masdar's hopes, but it never happened. Sir Peter Hall, Britain's leading expert on urban design, advised on the building of Dongtan and our own equally elusive eco-towns.
I feel terribly disappointed about Dongtan. It was very much a British scheme because Arups, our great civil engineering firm, were heavily involved in from the beginning. The problem, I think, was that it was essentially a speculative venture. Although the Chinese government blessed it, and indeed the Chinese president and Tony Blair, our prime minister, signed a document before the cameras, they essentially were leaving it to the private sector to build. And finally, I think that the commercial pressures proved too great. And that, I think, is a real problem that extends beyond Dongtan to our eco-towns, especially after the recession came. The risks of all this were just too great for them. They weren't able or willing to put in the additional investment that was required to make these eco-towns rather than bog-standard new suburban developments.
Which, of course, isn't a problem that Masdar suffers from, backed as it is by the extremely wealthy royal family of Abu Dhabi.
Exactly, and that is probably one of the few places where you can hope to achieve this.
Should we be building new cities to create a sustainable future?
What about working on our old ones?
I've thought a lot about this, and the answer is we really need to create some new cities as good examples, as models, and in fact to test them to see how they work. And then we can begin to retrofit the existing places. Now, I don't mean waiting for 20, 30, 40 years to do the second. I mean a constant process of learning. And there are some things you can do pretty well immediately. But I would say that they're a lot harder to do in existing places.
It's early days, but what do you hope cities like London might learn from eco-cities like Masdar?
Well, I think what they'd first learn is how to organise and reshape their transport systems. And that's one of the trickiest problems in transport planning in cities, because we tend overall to be living lives which are less centre-oriented and more edge-oriented, i.e. we live in homes at the edges of cities and we have jobs at the edges of cities and we shop at the edges of cities, and all this tends to make you more car-dependent. What we can hope to learn from new cities like Masdar is how to make everyone mobile without excessive dependence on the car.
Never mind dependence. Outside the Masdar building site here in the rest of the Emirates, I'd say they pretty much worship the car. We're here with Costing the Earth this week to see if this eco-city emerging from the desert can inspire its own followers. I'm going to step into my PRT, as it's called, Personalised Rapid Transit vehicle, and it is a pod with seats facing either way. It's very sleek inside, and what I understand will happen, I'll be able to program it to go to certain destinations, and then it will go there without a driver, and I presume it will sense other vehicles on the road and not crash into them. They've only got 10 private vehicles at the start and 3 freight, and that's partly because I think the whole thing is fairly experimental, and I don't think they should necessarily be ashamed of that. If you're pushing the boundaries, you don't necessarily want to buy hundreds all at once and find they don't work very well.
Oh, here it comes. It's like a giant loaf of bread on wheels with headlights. It's about the size of, I don't know, a small transit van and the shape of an iron, as in the sort of thing you do your ironing with. It's just gone by. It's completely silent. Oh, it's drawing in. It's a driverless car. There's somebody in it, but she is not driving it. It's running on magnets. It's been programmed so it knows where it's going. And inside is the lady who's in charge of this new form of transport, Mrazara Alameri.
What excites me is that it's challenging, it's ambitious. It's the first time to be implemented in the world, especially at this scale. And it's never been done for passengers before. Before, it was used to be used for moving and transporting cargo, but this is the first time that it's done for people. And as you see, the vehicle is very prestigious, and it will help in doing the transmission between using our personal driver cars and going later to more cleaner, sustainable technologies. So it's more like a taxi on demand that can take you from destination to A to destination B. It's located in what we call the undercroft, so it's a layer of a street ground layer. On top of it, we have the pedestrians, so it's a pedestrian-friendly city, and PRT is supposed to be our internal transportation system, one of them, not all of them, because on the top, on the podium level, we have what we call the LRT, some people call it the monorail, and we have the metro, and we also encourage people to walk through our microclimate. At the moment, for the first phase for university, which is Masdar Institute 1A and Masdar Institute 1B, we have 10 vehicles for passengers, 2 VIPs and 8 standard ones.
What's the difference between a VIP and a standard one?
The only difference between them is the interior finishing. One of them is with the pure leather, and the other one is an artificial so that it can become more durable. We need to use what we call the 100 million rubs.
Emiratis love their cars. Will they learn to love these?
I'm an Emirati, so I love my PRT.
But is there any real evidence that Emiratis care about sustainable energy, while their carbon emissions per head make even Americans look frugal? Well, they are holding this World Future Energy Conference, just a sandy stretch from Masdar, and here I met Stefan Lehmann, UNESCO Chair of Sustainable Urban Development for the Asia and Pacific region.
Stefan, you've been out to Masdar. What do you think about it?
It's a very innovative, cutting-edge project. It's fantastic to see that it's going ahead, and it's going to be an important testbed for innovative technology for the future.
It's difficult to tell at the moment because it's only half built, but who do you think will want to live there?
That's a big question mark you're raising. What are the kind of communities that we're going to see there that would like to live out there next to the airport? That's something that hasn't been probably addressed yet.
And when you say live out there next to the airport, you're not making it sound very attractive.
Well, at the moment, I think it has a good chance to become a very interesting business park and, you know, a great research center. What we have to look at now at Masdar is how to make it more livable and how to make it attractive for people to live there, not only families, but, you know, a rich mix of diversity of different groups that might want to live out there. That hasn't been happening enough yet, I would say.
Do you think it was the right approach for the Emirates or for Abu Dhabi to say, let's build a brand new city?
Well, I personally would have preferred to see, first of all, an approach to fix the existing Abu Dhabi, the problems that we have in Abu Dhabi city as it is right now, energy hungry, fossil fuel based on air condition dependency, even glass buildings, you know, in such a climate
still
are a disaster.
Going up as well.
Still going up, because you're just creating another air condition dependent box, you know. That's a model that I would think is very much 20th century thinking. And the future of the city is not about this. And it's still happening. So we urgently need this paradigm shift, a new understanding how we can live in a low carbon society. Energy is still too cheap here in the Emirates, and it's going to change, and we're going to have to adapt to that. We need to upgrade the existing city, and those kind of projects are infill projects, urban infill, densification, intensification, and compactation models to make it more compact, more mixed use, and better connectivity for pedestrians to walk.
So given that the rulers of Abu Dhabi don't seem to be doing an awful lot with their existing cities, do you think they take this problem of sustainable living seriously or not?
Well, they're going to have to sooner or later. And you see, if you go to Abu Dhabi now, the space between those randomly placed high-rise towers is car parking and awful. There's a big draft, wind blows, and it's very uncomfortable. It's not a place where you want to stay.
And, no, we walked around it last night, and it's actually an uncomfortable place to walk.
And it hasn't got anything to do with the quality that we are used from the bazaar, the souk, you know, the cities that we can visit in the Arab world that work so well, where there's life on the street and it's buzzing and vibrant and it's mixed used and all that. You know, it's fantastic. So we can learn from those models and the way they apply passive design principles, which, you know, come from a pre-air conditioned time, before there was air condition. Air condition, unfortunately, made us all very lazy.
We're just emerging onto a street for what will be the finished Masdar City, and the first thing you notice, aside from the fact that there's plenty of noise, a building going on, is that the buildings are quite close together. They're only maybe 4 or 5 metres apart. You get that feeling of being in a canyon, like in old-fashioned cities, really. And the reason for this is to keep as much shadow on the side of the buildings as possible, and as little direct sunlight. Constantly battling to reduce the heat you're gaining from that incredibly strong sun is really what they're all about in the design here. And when you look up, you can see the fascia on the building is really pretty radical. It's really interesting. It's a sort of terracotta colour. It's like a vertical wave on the outside. And cut into it is a sort of screen that looks a bit like a mosaic. It's quite reminiscent of those kind of slightly Arabic, slightly North African screens you get on the outside of buildings.
Austin Relton, partner at Foster & Partners.
Austin, explain the extraordinary design of these apartments to me.
Okay, well, the apartments, if we start with the cladding and we work from the outside in, the first layer you can see is GRC, which is glass-reinforced concrete. It's essentially sand. That is the one local material we have here, so obviously you want to try and use that as much as possible.
Plenty of that.
Plenty of that. You'll then pick up the Arabic screen, the modern interpretation of an Arabic screen we've got here. This provides privacy and it also stops direct sunlight hitting the glass.
What about the stuff I can't see? What's happening on the roof to keep the heat out?
Yeah, on top you can see the steel structure going up now. This basically holds the PV layer. 80% of the roof is covered with PVs. This is all about
photovoltaic.
This is all about the carbon neutral story, where the buildings at Masdar have to generate as much energy as they consume. We're trying to move away from the business as usual solution that you get typical of the region, where you air condition everything, and that means you go from somewhere very, very hot to somewhere very, very cold. Your body has to work very hard to keep itself cool. We've obviously returned to traditional Arabic design principles, and we've done that by getting rid of the car from the urban planning grid. We can push the buildings very close together, 4 metres, 6 metres, 10 metres maximum in some of the main urban routes.
Have you looked back at old Arabic cities?
Very much, very much. I mean, like, we've got a modern interpretation of a wind tower. It brings air into the street, it cools down the street even further, again reducing felt temperature.
Do you worry what will happen when real people start living in there and kind of messing up your grand ideas?
Certainly not in the Institute, because the Institute is a living lab, really. One of the things the wind tower does is act like a beacon. So it's got an LED lighting system. If it glows red, we know the students know that they're using a lot of carbon.
Right.
It's 45 metres tall, so you can see it from the airport, you can see it from the marina, all around. So, you know, it's a major piece.
So if the community is being a bit sinful in carbon terms, it glows red, does it?
And if it
doesn't point a finger at the particular apartment that's causing it.
If it glows blue, the university is doing very, very well.
We've done programmes before about other eco-cities, Dongtan in particular, that turned out, you know, frankly, we all ended up with a bit of egg on our face. Do you think this is really going to be different?
I think if everyone stays bold and stays true to the vision, I think, yes, it will be different.
I'm Sue Rofe, and I'm Professor of Architectural Engineering at Heriot Watt University.
I mean, it's interesting, when you're in a conference like this, everyone's talking about sustainable cities. One might get lulled into thinking that sustainable cities were now the norm.
Oh, absolutely not. And I think we're so far away from low-carbon dreams that a lot of people are saying, how can we get to where we need to in time?
When you look at, the model of what Masdar will be like when it's completed, can you trace various designs there through to their history that you know about?
Cities and Erbil has been continuously occupied for something like 7,000 years, the oldest occupied city, so they can work. But what is quite interesting is that they work in terms of the constraints of their local environment, whereas here they're expecting a Middle Eastern desert city to operate as you'd expect in Phoenix, Arizona. Well, it doesn't work in Phoenix, Arizona very well. So what I'm hoping is that they will relearn the principles on which Middle Eastern desert cities operate best, and then perhaps begin to export them back to Phoenix, Arizona, because it's going to need all the help it can get.
I've been out to Masdar and I've been in the exhibition here, and I think this is all fantastic, and I spoke to a lot of very enthusiastic people and I get very positive about it. And then I go into the outside world here, or even I have a look at some of the stands and what they're actually selling, and I'm thinking, hang on a minute, this is the emperor's new clothes. You know, this is just a fig leaf over an otherwise naked emperor, if you see what I mean. I mean, it's just still an oil-hungry, dependent culture here, isn't it?
Masdar is a paradigm-shifting development. The glass towers of Dubai, the glass towers of London, really have no long-term future. Their real nemesis, one of them here, is the fact that the Emirate subsidises all the electricity. So I estimated back of the envelope that by 2015, Abu Dhabi would be paying something like $50 billion a year. Well, that's fine until you start running out of the oil and you don't have enough to go around. So they've got a lot of Achilles heels in the development built in. But fundamentally the problem is that, does this region have the capacity to support this level of development? Do they have the water, the power? For instance, Burj Dubai, if it's going to use on and off a gigawatt for its water desalination, its transport, its cooling, they only have 4.6 gigawatts of generation capacity in Dubai.
So a quarter of the power for Dubai goes into the Burj?
Well, if that was full on and fully operational, which I doubt it will ever be, yes.
So in terms of lessons needing to be learnt,
Masdar is kind of in the right place to teach the people, isn't it?
Exactly. So Masdar's not just a product in a city, it's a process for learning.
Picking my way past stalls hawking electric supercars and solar-powered speedboats, I joined Khaled Awad, director of the Masdar project.
Actually, Masdar is core to the architecture of the Middle East. It is rooted in hundreds of years of architecture.
Is the real power of Masdar its ability to set an example? Because when I look around Abu Dhabi and, well, other places in the Middle East, I can still see plenty of steel and glass and designs based on the car going up all around me, can't I?
Well, absolutely. That's why we need a place where it is based on showing by doing, rather than just talking about policies and other things. Let's do it, show that it works, learn from it, and then start replicating it.
If, or hopefully when, I come back to visit the Middle East in 20 or 30 years, how common will cities like Masdar or the examples set by Masdar be then, do you think?
I think it's beyond Masdar. What you'll see in the Middle East, especially in the Gulf, is a completely different look. You know, oil has been here for 40 years, 38 years now, and oil has given you all this infrastructure that you see around you. Today you have leadership that is still environmentally responsible, like the old Sheikh Zayed, the late Sheikh Zayed, but they have more resources, they have more knowledge, they have more education, and they are putting sustainability on the top priority of their agenda.
I can see that students would want to live there, business people would want to live there, but how confident are you that families, real communities, will want to live in Masdar?
Well, I think I'm very confident because the lifestyle, and this is part of our thinking and our day-to-day planning, the lifestyle is a priority. People have to feel comfortable in this place, and they will feel in a very inviting environment where they are working and living in the same place, having access to retail, to entertainment, in one area where they can walk. They are not impeded by cars. Quality of air is much better than any other street in the Gulf and in the world because of the absence of cars. And I think that alone will bring you the safety, health and happiness.
At the outset, I suspected Masdar would be little more than a green mirage masking typical urban swank. But it is more genuine than that. The Crown Prince is putting serious petrodollars into a green living testbed. There are real questions over whether money could be better spent on a sustainable refit of existing buildings, but given architects have a role in shaping living spaces of the future, I'll give Gerard Evenden, Chief Architect of Masdar, the last word.
We're not trying to make architectural shapes. What we're trying to do is really truly produce buildings which have a reason and a meaning.
So this will be an icon, will it?
I think the city will change the world. I think it will change how people think. And I think it will have a huge effect on the way people perceive communities in the region. And if that's an icon, then yes, it will be.